Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week we are joined by, well, something of a national treasure. Having made a splash with its early pathos-infused comedies, Human Remains and Marion and Jeff, he's gone on to become one of the most well-known faces on UK TV. From his work on Gavin and Stacey, hosting Would I Lie to You, and appearing alongside Steve Coogan on The Trip. Yes, my guest today is, of course, the brilliant Rob Brydon. And over the next hour, we talk about the tenacity required to make it in this industry.
Your friends are telling you you have what it takes, and in other circumstances you've been funny, but now you're at Up the Creek on a Tuesday night, whatever it was, miles from your home in lovely cosy West London, and you are dying. And I remember going, oh my God, Rob, you cannot spend any of the money that you have in the bank because you have no future.
We also discover what it felt like when success eventually arrived. That's all on this episode of the Savoy Originals. Now, just before we dive in, a huge thanks to our sponsor, Laurent Perrier, for bringing something very special to today's episode. Today, we are celebrating with Laurent Perrier Heritage. But did you know this champagne has a royal seal of approval? Back in 1998, Laurent Perrier was awarded the Royal Warrant by none other than His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, a testament to its commitment to quality and environmental care. So here's to those who appreciate quality as much as we do. Cheers. Rob Brydon, here's to you, a true original, sir.
Oh, about that, but thank you. I'll always accept champagne. I love the ceremony of champagne, seeing it in the ice bucket, but not too much of it.
Well, welcome to the Savoy.
This will shock you.
Go on.
I met my wife at this hotel.
Really?
Yes, I did. I think it was 2002. She was working on the South Bank show, Melvin Bragg, and they had an award ceremony every year, and I was lucky enough to be invited to this ceremony, and I saw her across the bar on the first floor where there was a pre-awards bash. I thought, oh, she's nice. I also met Elvis Costello that day, so it was absolutely, it was one of the best days of my life. Then there were drinks in the American bar, mm-hmm. and that was where I mean, pounced sounds...
Scary.
In this age. Yeah, that's when I approached.
Yes, nice. Well, I hope this interview is as special as meeting your wife.
And Elvis Costello.
And Elvis Costello in the same
who was day. Aware of my work. I mean, it would be one thing to have met Elvis Costello and him say, who the hell are you?
Right.
And this was a long time ago, but he'd seen the stuff I'd done and he was very flattering. And so you can imagine. In many ways, you know, the way things have panned out, that was a bigger deal than meeting my wife.
Well, we're going to get on to...
Elvis Costello.
Elvis Costello. That's part two of the interview. It's very Elvis Costello heavy. But I want to start by going back to the beginning of your career, because as I understand it, you did want to be in show business from a very young age. Do you think there's a quality you possessed way back then that has shaped the way you approach your work even today?
I suspect I was always a people pleaser. I like to get on with people and entertain them. So I had that from a young age. You know, my parents tell me that I would, you know, go behind the sofa and then come out and sort of do a turn, you know, or go behind long curtains and sort of open them. And I would naturally want to impersonate Kermit the Frog to make my friends laugh because I could, because I had the ability to sound like other people, and not everybody does. And the thing I always say is, you know, some kids could do keepy uppies, couldn't they? And that was amazing. They could do that. I couldn't do that. But I did have the ability to sound like other people. That was the first thing. You know, did the usual things, nativity plays. I think I would have been 12 and Star Wars was a big hit. And with a group of friends, we mounted a stage production of Star Wars.
What?
I know, which would have involved writing a script, I played Luke Skywalker, and we bought the plastic Darth Vader mask. I went out the front of the... In my memory, there was a front cloth, there was a curtain. I don't know if there was. I went out and stood there and did jokes from the Two Ronnies joke book. And years later, I became very, very friendly with Ronnie Corbett. And I would have stood there and done some of the jokes. At the top of their show, they did news headlines. In a packed program tonight, yep. We'll be talking to joke, joke, joke. And I did those. And I can remember one of them, seeing a teacher stood at the side looking a little disapprovingly because it was a little bit racy. When I was stood there out the front just by myself, being pretty relaxed with it, it didn't faze me, and enjoying that position of having them there. That feels quite natural to me. You know, people talk about, oh, I couldn't stand up. Oh, I didn't want,
yeah.
I'm pretty comfortable with it.
It's a weird thing, isn't it? I very much agree when people go, how do you do stand-up?
Yes.
It's like, how do I not do stand-up? I need that.
And that's the key word. I think whenever young actors come up to me and they say, or young comedians, I'm thinking, well, maybe they're at school, I'd like to do this. I say, well, you really have to do it.
Mm.
It has to be like a calling, because it's not going to be easy unless you are the luckiest person in the world. It's not going to be easy. So you're going to have that need to do it to see you through.
And what was it acting that interested you at that point? Because you did audition for the famous RADA.
Yes.
Was it more acting than comedy, or was the comedy already bleeding into the acting?
Well, I'd always had a comedic bent and worshipped at the altar of Barry Humphreys, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, Peter Sellers, Ronnie Corbett, Ronnie Barker, Leonard Rossiter, Kenneth Williams, Larry Grayson, Joan Rivers, so many people. And I, without realizing it, studied them, really. I can see that now, that what I was doing was studying them. My thinking was, well, at school, where I didn't do very well academically, at school, what I love is the drama lessons and the drama rehearsals for the big musical that we would do each year. Sweet Charity, West Side Story, Guys and Dolls and Carousel were the four that I was there for, starring with Ruth Jones in most of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met her at Porthcawl. And I remember thinking, I want a whole day doing drama. So you go to drama school. That's what you did, you know. So you audition for RADA and Central, and you go up to London, you get turned down. Not surprisingly, I mean, when I think back to going into those auditions, I must have looked incredibly green and provincial and naive.
Mm.
I remember the RADA one, my memory of it, very hazy, but it is of a dozen young Rufus Sewells. With the greatest of respect to Rufus, because I've seen him be bloody good in some things.
Yeah.
That's a joke. It's a joke. It's Rufus Sewell. What does he care? But, you know, Rufus with his... I don't know if he still has the long hair now, but he used to have the Byronic hair.
Yeah.
And I picture him in a coat. And I remember being in the room waiting to go in. And I just thought, God, I'm out of my depth here, you know. And so it proved. But when I auditioned then for Cardiff, which is a terrific school... I don't know, they must have seen something in me, and they said yes.
Because there is a thing about drama schools. I remember reading that RADA and a lot of the schools in London do prefer people to have, in inverted commas, lived a bit before they actually come to drama schools, because to act, you know, you probably need some life experience.
That's interesting, yeah. Well, I think I was a late developer. I think young for my age. Yeah, he's in the characters, you know, in Keith Barrett and Marion and Jeff. He's looking at the world like that. Bryn, which I have nothing to do with the writing of, but, you know, I play, is also that. So obviously there's something in me, you know. It's not a total transformation, you know.
I love this. I think there's a quote from you where you say, you act like everyone in the room knows more than you do about what's going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there was a bit we did in the trip I remember being quite pleased with, where I did a little bit where I say, something along the lines of, oh, no, when I'm playing part Steve, you know, I'm very da, da, da. And then I go, oh, no, I'm not, am I? I'm like that. And then that is that's a starting point for a kind, for often what I'll do. But in my stand-up, and you see it in Bryn a little bit, you know, and you saw it in this last special, when he gets angry with Gwen. That's one of my favourite things in that show, is when Bryn would become antagonistic. And when I do my own shows, and it's sort of thing I really took from Barry Humphries, is talking to the audience and then turning on the audience. But when I used to do it as Keith Barrett, I would do it in such a sort of naive way. You know, have you come for a funeral? Look at you, the way you're dressed. You look like a Pied Piper on his way to the funeral, something like that, right? And Edna would, oh, darling, she would do that sort of thing. And that would be where I'd get that from. But if I get cross with an audience member, that works really well for me. Mm. Because I think the general perception is that I'm very like that. So when I get angry, that plays really well.
And it's an amazing discovery, isn't it, when you realise for the first time that you can do that to an audience.
Yes.
And they will go with it.
Well, especially because it's what you've seen in the people you love. So I'd seen Barry doing it. Oh, this kind of works for me as well. The great story about Elvis Presley, who I'm always compared to, when he was in his early days, he'd say, why are they screaming? Well, you're shaking your leg. Oh, I'll do it again. You know, you learn what people like, and you naturally, oh, well, okay, all right, well, let's, okay, well, you have more of this then.
So I'd like to talk now about some of the incredible achievements in your career and some of the struggles, which you kind of hinted at when you were talking about.
Could we spend longer on the incredible achievements? And I mean, really looking to both of them and really stretch them out.
Before we get to those incredible achievements.
Some of the lows.
Minor struggles. I do want to ask you something that we ask every guest, which is why you think you have succeeded where others simply have not.
Persistence, tenacity, didn't give up. Mm. Talent's important, but more important is just don't give up. You find another way.
Because the start of the 90s, you came out of the blocks at speed. You dropped out of drama school after a year and a half. And weirdly, we both did the same thing, which was move from uni into very early radio shows, which you were on BBC
Wales.
Wales.
Radio Wales, 6:30 to 7:30. I'd never done hospital radio. I'd never done anything like that. And I said yes, and I left college pretty much halfway through a three-year course. And it used to terrify me because in those days, it was all on vinyl, and they would give you a running order for the show, all typed out, and you'd get the name, you know, Evil Woman, Electric Light Orchestra, duration, intro, and a box then with all the discs in. I would take the box of records home the night before and practice. And quite a while after it, if I ever had an anxiety dream, it would often relate to being in a studio and seeing a record playing and the needle was 3/4 of the way through the record. Because that meant, oh God, what am I going to say?
To go back to your word tenacity, it was, when I started at XFM, they said, we can't give you a producer. Can you run your own desk? And ooh, I said, yes, having never run a desk before
so
in my
what
life.
Did you, so what did you do?
I snuck in. I made friends with the overnight DJ when the station was empty. And bless him, he taught me how to use the desk.
But
that first show was just a bit like your anxiety dream. It's just terrifying.
I used to have dreams as well where turntables would be on fire. Honestly.
Sorry,
so it's the equivalent of the actor's anxiety dream, which I've had these as well, which is you're in the wings and either you can't find the stage, right? So you're like Spinal Tap. Right?
Yeah.
You can't find the stage, or you can find where you're meant to go on, but you don't know the play. Why are we doing this? I don't know this play. All those things can be terribly chilling.
So from that early morning slot, I mean, you ascended the ranks of BBC Wales, but then eventually the editor there changes.
That's right.
And you get let go.
Yeah.
At that point, how are you feeling? Are you feeling like, don't worry, another gig is just around the corner.
In a macro sense, yes, but in a micro sense, oh dear, because I have to pay my bills. Certainly my expenditure exceeded my income. And there was a period when I think this would have been the early 90s. I think I had a £5,000 overdraft. It was a lot of money. And I owed £4,000. They'd given me a loan as well. And then that changed when I got a job as a Shopping Channel presenter. I had an agent in Cardiff and she said, I got you an audition in London. I thought, oh, what's this going to be? Film, theatre, Shopping Channel. Sky had just started. And there, so it's not QVC, this was another entity. It was something to do with Grattan's catalogues.
Okay.
And maybe Next. And so I took the job. It was like three times what I was making on the radio. And in my naivety, of which we spoke earlier, I thought, well, there we go, this is a way in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Not realizing that if you go to a casting director and you say, yes, I'm working on the Shopping Channel as a host, they are not going to consider you for anything.
How would you describe, in general, this period of the 90s in your career? Because you were working as a voiceover artist as well. You were a continuity announcer.
Yeah, I've done it all.
You've done it all. Is it what you wanted to be doing, though? What did you want to be doing at that period? Were you happy with doing that? And I guess I ask the question because I sometimes wonder if it's sometimes more painful to be in the industry but not doing the thing you quite want to do, doing something creative. Like I use the example of Tantalus's punishment in Greek mythology, where the fruit is just out of reach and every time he goes for it, it moves away because you're there, but it's not the part of the industry you want to be involved in.
That's exactly right, because initially I thought, well, I'll go to London. This is a way. You can't underestimate, you know, even though it was the Shopping Channel, London. I'm going to be working in London. You know, that's a big deal, right? How do you get to London? How do you get to work in London in show business? It's a Shopping Channel, Rob. Yes, but it's it's almost show business. I'll meet people there. So I did that. I was happy for a while. You know, the money helped. I wasn't thinking about stand-up then. Then that company went bust. So that was over. Oh, right. Sometime after that, I got a job again on Sky hosting a movie show called Exposure. And that looked at the week's new releases. We would always be in a different location, sometimes in Los Angeles or to New York to the film festivals and all these things. I interviewed Robin Williams once and,
wow,
and Andy McDowell for Groundhog Day. I interviewed her. Interviewed Quentin Tarantino when he came over with Reservoir Dogs. Mm-hmm. It was that era. I do remember when we went to Morocco to film Robin Williams making a Bill Forsyth film called Being Human, I think. And I got introduced to Robin Williams. So if you're in comedy, there is nobody higher, you know. And this is Rob, he's making the documentary. I only go, no, I'm one of you.
Yes.
I'm one of you guys.
All right.
And, you know, so that was going on. So I was, now with that movie show, well, I was in that world, but I was on the wrong side of the equation, you know. And then I got sacked from that. And again, a new controller coming in. Mm. It wasn't the people I was actually working with. It was a new guy. I do remember his name. And he took over, and he didn't like me. So he kept my female co-presenter, and he replaced me with Richard Jobson. Okay. He wanted someone with a prominent jaw, but not me. Now, by now, we'd bought a little house, a little flat up in London with my soon-to-be wife, first wife. Mm-hmm. So I'm out of work and I got a mortgage. And so I was thinking, well, everybody says you're good at voices, so get a voice agent. But I couldn't. I sent tapes to everybody. I ended up having to do one day as a telesalesperson in Kensington High Street selling environmentally friendly cleaning products. And I was doing it, and it was soul-destroying. I managed one morning. You had to lie to people. You'd phone them up and go, hi, who's there? Is this Wolfgang? Wolfgang, hello. Remember those guys? Where are you from? I'm from Hamburg. Oh, my God, that's right, my honeymoon. You're just lying. It's horrific, right? And you've got to get an order number from them. Came to the lunch break, and I went out onto Kensington High Street. I thought, I can't do this. And I left, and I walked away. But my thought process was this. I can do funny voices. Not everybody can. There must be a way that I can use this ability I have to pay the bills. So I just really blitzed agents, still failed, but also any contacts I had, continuity, promos, nothing sexy, not like adverts that pay well. These would be things like Mrs. Pepper Pot on B Sky B and things like that. And that started to pick up. And then I eventually managed to get a voice agent. And then it really snowballed. And I got to the point where I was doing 3 or 4 a day in Soho, making a very nice living.
I have a weird sort of movie-related question, which I think simultaneously exhibits both your tenacity and what you mentioned.
Naivety.
Naivety, yeah. I'd call it, which was writing to people like Kevin Costner.
That's right, yeah. And like, well, to whoever was making it. In those days, no internet. So if you wanted to know what was being cast, there was a thing, I think it was called PCR, and I think that stood for Professional Casting Report. And you would subscribe to this, pay money, and it would be sent to you through the post, a roundup of which casting directors were casting which things. And my memories of that are Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Mm-hmm. I wrote to them. Mm-hmm. I sent them my CV. And the other thing was I read that Richard Curtis, who, of course, I admired for Blackadder, mm-hmm. is making a film called 4 Weddings and a Funeral. And I my reaction to that was, what's he doing? You can't have a film called 4 Weddings and a Funeral. Well, that's going to tank, isn't it? I can always remember that. Well, yeah, I was writing to these people, but equally, I had friends who had graduated or come into the business the same time as me, and they were doing really well, you know, and they were being championed by casting agents. Very important for casting agents to like you. I didn't have any that really liked me. I couldn't get in through the door. I just couldn't, you know. But at the same time, I was aware that I was perceived as someone who was witty and funny. Mm-hmm. What was going on here? And when I started to do the voiceovers, for a while, that was very artistically, creatively satisfying, because in those days, more than now, because of budgets, they would have several actors in, acting out scenes. You don't get that so much anymore. So I could be in there. I was in there once with Donald Sinden and Pauline Quirk. It was an insurance thing based around the Noddy stories. I was Noddy, Pauline was Martha Monkey, and Donald Sinden was Big Ears. And I'm Noddy, I'm talking like this. I did an animation with Hugh Laurie. Wow, that was a Thursday before he'd done all those American things, but I adored Hugh Laurie for what he did with Stephen Fry. And that was a thrill. But then that wasn't enough. It was as if I was growing, I was sort of developing, maturing maybe, blossoming if you like. And suddenly just doing those little sketches wasn't enough. And that was when then I tried to get open spots and I became a bit more tenacious and what have you and tried to get things off the ground. I live in Strawberry Hill, Twickenham. My nearest place is a great place called The Bearcat, which is in St. Margaret's. It's where by total coincidence, is where I had my first ever stand-up gig, my first ever open mic, and I died on my ass. Absolute died on my ass. It was in the 90s, and I was doing voiceovers mostly then, and I had a demo tape that I'd recorded that was funny. We were doing impressions. Hugh Grant, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Chris Barry in the Britass Empire.
Oh.
Mark Little hosting the Big Breakfast. That was that.
I remember one
for the purists. And it was a funny tape. And people would hear it. Oh, that's a funny tape. So I thought, well, I'll just do the tape on stage. No, it's not enough. So I went out at the Bearcat. Oh, Lordy. And got introduced. And I just got nothing. Silence. Which is worse than heckled, because heckles have an energy you can use. Silence. My mouth got dry. Oh, God, I had to ask someone for a drink. And after that, I didn't do another gig for a year because it so upset me.
And how did, can I ask, because I had a similar experience with my first gig at the Dry Dock pub in Leeds, and weirdly considering it's you I'm talking to, the only laugh I got was for doing an impression of Michael Caine that was so appallingly bad.
Let's hear it.
No, absolutely not. I've never done it since. It's like it's triggering for me to even try and do it. But that's, I got one laugh for that, and it was a pity laugh.
Well, you don't want those.
But I did my second gig as quickly as possible to try and kill the memory of
very good. I found that really upsetting. So it was a year, but and then another really bad one was so a year went by, and then I got a gig at Up the Creek in Greenwich, I think, which was famously tough.
Yeah, Malcolm Hardy
ran it, and on that one I was doing these whimsical observations about being Welsh and growing up in Wales, and someone down the front went bah, like that. I just carried on, you know, as if I hadn't heard it, which I think is a mistake. And then he went, meh. And then another person, someone else, went, meh. And within about a minute, the whole room, everybody, they're all in agreement, I was rubbish. They're all going, meh, meh, meh. And oh, that's upsetting. And in my head, I mean, the humiliation. Because obviously, at this stage, somewhere deep inside yourself, you have a belief that you're funny. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it, right? You can be as self-effacing as you like, but at some level, you think you have what it takes. And your friends are telling you you have what it takes, and in other circumstances, you've been funny. You are the funny one. But now you're at Up the Creek on a Tuesday night, whatever it was, miles from your home in lovely, cosy West London, and you are dying. And this guy then, so they're all doing that, and the bloke down the front went, and I will bleep the words. He said, F off back to Wales, you, worst word you can say, you're not funny. Now that one, I remember driving home, and what that did to me was, because I was making a living by then as a voiceover person, and I remember going, oh my God, Rob, you cannot spend any of the money that you have in the bank because you have no future. I remember thinking, and I believed it. But the next day when I woke up, I went, no, I'll show them.
Yes.
So I'd moved on a bit. But you started this by saying you're in that world, but it's the wrong thing. Right. And I do remember watching the British Comedy Awards when I think you would have had the League of Gentlemen, Craig Cash and Caroline Ahern, and Steve was already established, Steve Coogan, and he's giving an award to Caroline. And I remember watching that on the telly and thinking, how will I ever get into that universe? It seemed utterly unattainable.
Now, as we savour this Laurent Perrier Heritage, it is amazing to think about the journey each bottle takes before it reaches us. Earlier, we mentioned the royal warrants granted in 1998 by His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. That was a proud moment for Laurent Perrier, recognising its quality and care for the environment. But now, they've made history again as the first champagne house to receive this honour from King Charles III. It is rare to find a champagne with such a legacy crafted to meet royal standards and bring pleasure to each sip. Here's to tradition, innovation, and the timeless elegance Laurent Perrier brings to every glass. Cheers.
You've mentioned this before. You've been asked this question, and I just want to establish like how much weight is actually attached to an appearance in a young filmmaker by the name of Guy Ritchie's Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah.
You got a name check in Empire's review. I'm just going to quickly read the review. The quartet over here, they're nastier neighbours planning on robbing a group of public school dope cultivators and decide to rip off the rip-off artists. Also mixed up in this escalating mess, Afrohead drug czar, Vass Blackwood, Eddie's bar-owning dad, Sting, but don't worry, he isn't in many scenes. Not my words, the words of reviewer Kim Newman.
Classic film reviewer snobbery towards mega successful, globally famous man Sting. I mean, you couldn't write it.
Kim Newman could and did. Middleman Nick the Greek, Steve Marcus, and an extremely unlucky traffic warden, Robert Bryden.
Look at that, yeah.
What did that feel special?
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
I remember reading that. We're on the Upper Richmond Road. We were living then in East Sheen. I got into the newsagents I haven't fallen out of love with film now, but it just doesn't hold the same. I loved it then. I used to read Empire all the time, right? And here I was in this film. But it was unknown. I mean, it was Guy Ritchie. Nobody knew him. So I'm with my family. I go into the newsagents. I get Empire. I look through, and I can remember where I was. And I, my God, I'm mentioned in Empire? But the canny part of me, the tenacious part of me went, this has a currency. There's something in this, because prior to that, I can't get any leverage. I can't get any traction, friction. I can't get any footholds, handholds. So what I did was, using the money I was earning on voiceovers, I rented a camcorder, good quality one. I wrote 4 character sketches. I went out with my best friend, filmed these things, rented an edit suite. I could do it on my phone now. Then rented a dub for the sound. Then I think I worked out the design for the cover, but then went to a printer, paid for them to print it, and I had 30 VHSs printed up. And I sent them all off hither and yon, and they all came back with the thud of defeat through the letterbox in jiffy bags. You'd hear them, oh God, that's one of my tapes. And you'd hear them being pushed through the letterbox, then silence, and then flabum. And it, dear Rob, dear Mr. Bryden, thank you for, unfortunately, yeah. And I used to carry one round with me. I once saw Sir Peter Hall walking up the street, and I thought about getting it out and giving it to him, which would have been ridiculous. I didn't. But then, 2 people, it was seen by Hugo Blick, who I ended up making Marion and Jeff with, who I'd been at college with. I didn't know him that well. I was at the BBC doing a voiceover. I hadn't sent him the tape. He was a producer person there. I thought, oh, if he said no, that'd be terrible. But I thought if I bumped into him, and literally as I thought this, he walked around the corner, and we had a coffee, and I said, oh, I've done this thing, gave it to him. He called me back about an hour later. I put the best character last, of course, idiot. He said, I like this character, and that's how it began. At the same time, Steve Coogan, via Julia Davis, who I knew, had said to Julia, if you ever write anything, bring it to me, not to talk back. And that's how we did Human Remains. But at the same time, I gave Steve, she showed Steve my demo tape. In fact, the one before, she showed him the general one that Hugo saw. And then we showed him what we shot as the pilot. And bless Steve, who has always had the courage of his convictions. Because I would see something and go, I think that person's good, but what do I know? But he has the courage of his convictions in everything he does, you know, to be fair to him. And it pains me to be fair to him, but I must. No, he had the courage of his convictions. And then when he got behind it, he and Henry Normal with Baby Cow, yeah, off we went.
I mean, just as a really weird aside, the fact that Hugo Blick is also the guy who says, have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight in Tim Burton's Batman, yeah, the most famous line from that movie. Yeah. When I was reading about him, it, yeah, blindsided me. I was like, what? But let's part that for a moment.
Apparently Hugo... was not short of confidence, and because he was an actor and then he became a writer. Now he's a writer, director, does everything, you know. He told me that when he went in, he went up to the producers and the casting, and they had all the photos of the other people coming in. And apparently he said he went up and he went, well, they won't do. Isn't that great?
So you mentioned Marion and Jeff already. Keith Barrett had been born a long time ago, I guess a kind of proto Keith,
yeah,
Barrett.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did him on the radio. When I was still employed on the radio, I gradually introduced comedy into what I was doing. And at some point I had a show that originated on Radio Wales but was broadcast on Radio 5 as well, because each night it was from a different region. We were Friday night, me and Alan Thompson, my late friend Alan Thompson, and we did a lot of characters. And that was where I was starting now to think, yeah, I can write comic characters. I can do this. And I had some lovely characters. Well, there was Keith, Tony and Keith. Keith was a taxi driver. The joke then was that she was having an affair, Marion was having an affair with Tony while I was driving a taxi. Now, when it went to the telly, it became that he drove a taxi because there was nothing else to do. I did a character called Conrad Bolivar, who was this German guy, you know, used to talk like this. And he was a big fan of Victor Spinetti. And he did a one-man show about the life of Victor Spinetti, who some of your listeners may not know, but Vic was a wonderful actor in all the Beatles movies and Oh, What a Lovely War. And he became a friend of mine. And so I did him, and he used to go, yoo-hoo, yoo-hoo. And Alan would say, oh, look out, I think Conrad's here. And I go, Alan, how are you? Tappity-tap. He would tap dance. And he had an uncle called Klaus. And Klaus would talk like this. I am looking for Conrad. Have you seen him? And they would say, why are you wearing those leather trousers? It's none of your business. And it was all that kind of thing. And we had a guy called Jeremiah Fanny of the Fine Fanny Four, Bodmin's finest trad folk fusion band, previously Threepenny Bit, and then the bit had to split and we became, so I'm Jeremiah Fanny, and he told like that. And we had an American called, hi, like a Casey Kasem figure, I'm Bob Goldentown, host of cable television's longest running, he presented a show.
Bob
Goldentown. I sounded like Jeff Goldblum. And he hosted Lucky Lobsters, the only water-based game show for the over 60s. And in over 30 years on air, only 12 fatalities. So I did him. So I did all sorts. And that was giving me confidence, you see.
And Keith Barrett was obviously, I remember seeing Marion and Jeff though when it first aired, and I remember really loving it. And it wasn't until I rewatched it much later and was going through my own divorce that I really understood the pathos in it, and it, wow, yeah. it really hit me. What was it like for you making that show and seeing
well,
it?
Well, my first marriage ended after we'd done that. So it wasn't a, curious, I don't know, maybe I've analyzed this, I don't know. But I mean, to me, it was a funny character,
yeah.
Right? It was, when we'd done him, he was Keith, because Keith is a thin sounding name. His surname is Barrett, because that's Shakin' Stevens' real surname. And the joke was he was his cousin. And Marion, because Marion sounds funny when I say it like that, Marion, right? Those are the reasons, no other reasons.
Yeah.
And then you've got the classic comedy of somebody being cuckolded, of being a false witness, an unreliable witness, right? You've got that. It was kind of cartoony, you know, and we would sing songs as well on the radio, you know. And then Hugo and I together created this beautifully rich backstory, and off we went. And it changed everything for me. We shot it in the spring of 2000. Then in the summer of 2000, we shot Human Remains, which Baby Cow got commissioned again. Baby Cow got Marion and Jeff commissioned. And I was going, wow. And all of a sudden now, I can't overstate how I felt I'd come home. Because now I'm with people like Steve, like Henry, like Julia, like Hugo. Oh, yeah, these are my people. This is... It's hard to put into words.
But it did actually feel like,
yes.
I'm interested.
Tangible, tangible.
Right.
Tangible.
So you did sort of, like, if not actually, but emotionally celebrate. You were aware that there'd been a sea change.
Oh, yeah. Because just prior to it, I was thinking, this is not going to happen. That's okay. I'll be a voiceover artist. That's okay. I'll get a job on some local radio station. That's not so bad. That's not a bad life, you know. But I was thinking that I'd missed the boat.
I do just want to touch on Human Remains, because obviously it's a phenomenal series. If people haven't seen it, it's one of the darkest things I've ever had.
Most people haven't seen it. That, you know, I always notice whenever there are profiles of Julia, it's never mentioned. It's very rarely mentioned in profiles of me. It's as if she didn't do anything before Nighty Night, and you want to go... Watch Human Remains, because it's certainly one of, some would say, it's the best thing I've ever done, you know.
It's an incredible show. And obviously, you mentioned 1990 there. Julia Davis obviously has a pitch black sense of humour. When you were working
she's
with
also
her,
got a silly sense of humour, you see. Everybody latches on to, oh, pitch black, but there's a lot more.
Mm.
She also has an appreciation of the silly as well.
So in terms of that working then relationship between you and her, were you in a similar sort of frame of mind in terms of like, let's really go for the dark, or were you kind of the balancing force?
I think we balanced each other out, but I think that it was just such a chemistry. I met her in an improv group. Mm. We were in an improv group in Bath and Bristol. And I can remember we played a festival in Bristol, I think, an outdoor thing. And I have a memory of being on stage there, looking in her eyes, and we're doing a thing and thinking, oh yeah, we've got a thing. There's a chemistry, there's a rhythm. And then years went by. I lost track of her. And then she came to London. And I've always said, with indecent haste, was working with the best. She's working with Steve. She's working with... I sound like Bryn. He's driving our bus, taking us down the bingo in his bus. She's working with Chris Morris, this mythical figure of comedy. Does he exist? We don't know, right? She's doing stuff with Graham and Arthur on Big Train. Mm. With Simon. Oh, she's gosh. Doing everything, you know. Mm. Now, at this stage... I adored Steve because he was doing what I wanted to do. He's doing character comedy, and he'd started out in voiceovers. So it showed me, well, there is a path, right? And he'd done crap early on. He was on the Krypton Factor reconstruction. So, you know, that's his shopping channel. You know, like you could see that you could go from that to something good. So she told me she was going to work with Steve. And I remember the first day of rehearsal she had for his live show, I phoned her up and said these words... What's he like? That's how much I wanted to know. And she said, oh, he said this funny thing when Peter Bainham was there and he asked somebody for a sandwich and then Steve said such and such. I go, oh! I was that much of a fan, right? So she now gets to know Steve and Henry and they can see how talented she is and they say, if you ever write anything, Julia, don't take it to talk back, take it to us. She says to me, they said, why don't we try and write something? Okay, so we got together in town in some little... I used to be a member of a members place called Blacks. We met in there with a pen and a pad and produced nothing. Absolute zero. It was so dispiriting. And my memory of this now, Julia may correct me on this, but my memory is that we were going to pack it in. Maybe that's just too dramatic for the story, I don't know. And I said, well, let's try one more, but this may be wrong. Let's just film ourselves, I said, because we can improvise, you and I, because we used to do it in the improv group. So the next day, I had a little camcorder. I was always at the cutting edge of technology, so I had a camcorder, and we set it up, and oh my God, it just flowed. Part of that, from my perspective, was I was fit to burst, because I'm about 33, 34 now when we started doing that, right? And I had this belief that I should be doing these comic things, but I couldn't get anywhere with it. I was kind of going, but I can do this. I can do this. Let me show you what I can do. And I learned you have to show people. You can't tell them.
Yeah.
You've got to show.
Yeah.
So we start improvising, and it's all out there. It's on the DVD of the series, and it's on YouTube, the writing sessions and everything. Whole chunks of the script just arrive. Bump, you know. Just doing voices. We wouldn't say, oh, let's do a couple who are this and that. We just sat there like that and say, I mean, your sister, how long has she been with us now? She goes, oh, 5 years, whatever it was. Yeah, she's not a bother. Well, I mean, that's the beauty of a coma, isn't it? They're not judgmental.
Oh, God.
Things like that.
The phrase Slytherin will never leave me. It's...
Well, that was before Slytherin, of course, with Harry Potter.
Yes, yes.
That was a different thing. This was we chose the titles. They'd always be a little line. So there was an English squeak, which is Flick, the posh woman. She says, well, Nana is our maid. I mean, of course, she doesn't speak a word of our language. You're very lucky if you get so much as an English squeak from her. And Slytherin was Gordon and Sheila, who were swingers. She's covering her hands in hand cream as they get ready for bed. And she says, come on, Jay, Slytherin. Or do I? I can't remember. I say to her, she says,
no, you say to her.
I say to her.
You lift the duvet up and go.
And I say Slytherin because her hands are all.
Yeah.
That episode was nearly, all through the writing, was called The Onset of Winter, which is from, they talk about, you know, I think we all have to have a few little knickknacks around the house, you know, like little few little pieces of art. You know, a dormouse be right in the onset of winter.
I mean, this seems like a good time to ask a question we ask all our guests, because as we're talking about it right now, you've created some truly unique and memorable characters and shows over your career. So with all the experience and knowledge that you have now, what do you think it takes to be original, to create an original piece of work?
Well, I think you either have it in you or you don't, and I think you have to find your own voice and get to the stage where you're not aping other people. Be inspired by them, take things from them, but trust your own voice. Took me a long time to do that.
You mentioned Steve Coogan earlier. Obviously, the trip is just it's a meta masterpiece, one of the finest shows on TV from the last 15 years. It's wonderful. How would you describe your relationship, working and personal, with Steve Coogan?
I adore Steve. I am full of admiration for Steve. You know, I subscribe to those Partridge channels on Instagram and stuff. I can sit there watching those. It's a work of genius. And in Tim Key now, he's got this guy that just works so beautifully with him, and in the Gibbons with the writing. I could watch that forever. Our relationship started out very much me arriving as the fan. And then slowly this kind of on-screen relationship developed through Michael Winterbottom observing when we did 24-Hour Party People, which I have a very small part in. But we improvised a lot of that, and it was that little niggly thing. I just always found it fun to niggle at Steve, you know, and him be pompous and me be earnest and but a bit sly and all that stuff.
You do feel like, and I don't think it's an overstatement, say like comedic soulmates.
That's lovely. That's lovely to hear.
But you're not really officially a double act.
Or he wouldn't like to be thought of as a double act. I don't mind. He wouldn't like it because he is very ambitious and very... I think you know, things matter to him, you know, which is why he's achieved what he has, you know.
And I don't want to oversimplify it. I may be off the mark here, but I guess... In the biopic of your life, there could be a moment where you're walking into the BBC to do live continuity in the the 90s, and Steve Coogan screams past in his red Porsche, knowing me, knowing you.
Yeah, that's
you.
Right.
At that point,
you could. Yeah, that could happen. Like, that would be. I mean, it never did, but it easily could have. He would have been screeching by somewhere, you know. So I could easily or. I never did live continuity nationally. I did that in Wales. In London, I did, and with Match of the Day at 10, that Saturday night on BBC One. And that it was when I was recording one of those that I bumped into Hugo Blick and gave him the tape. But yeah, if you were doing the biopic, I mean, what sort of budget are we talking about? But if some strange chain of events saw them making a biopic, then... It would be tempting, wouldn't it, to have me schlepping around Soho doing voiceovers, and you'd choose some of the less salubrious. Like I was the voice of the guy on the tape when, if you were going to have a colonoscopy, you watched this video the night before. That was me, right? And Steve would be bars with women in the back, and he'd be, so you look out, it's a Mazda, you know. You could have that, yeah.
So to go from him being an influence on you in the 90s to then sort of being co-leads on the trip, is it ever weird, or is it just not?
It's not weird. I sometimes, it's one of those things, you know, it's smell the roses. It's a great thing. When I first got to know him, I would sometimes be frustrated. He's not a people pleaser, right? So I would sometimes be frustrated by his reluctance to perform or entertain. I don't think he gets a natural buzz out of an audience. I think he sees an audience as a useful ingredient when concocting the science of his comedy to tell him if the experiment has succeeded or failed. But I don't think he loves his audience. I like my audience. I love them at times, but I'm certainly very fond of them.
We can touch on possibly one of the biggest audiences you've ever reached, because we said goodbye to Gavin and Stacey over Christmas, which, and I didn't realise this at the time until I did my research, became one of the most watched, if not the most watched, scripted TV shows of the century.
I think you'll find it's the second. It's the most, yes.
It is the most on UK TV.
I feel like I have to pick you up on that. I wouldn't want there to be any doubt.
20 million viewers at Christmas, the last Christmas special ever, but this is from a fairly low-key opening or series on BBC Three. Great reviews, but not, you know, BBC Three, not widely watched. You're filming that. I guess the question is, you never know what is going to be a success, do you?
You know, you can think it's good. I think this is really good. I think I had some copies on DVD quite a while before it came out. And I remember lending one to my brother-in-law, who was younger than me, and he loved it, and he showed it to some mates, and they loved it. And there's the response, a bit we were saying earlier about word of mouth. Oh, yeah, people seem to like this now. You would never have predicted that it would do what it did. I mean, I was involved in Little Britain. I script edited the second series and I acted in the third. And I remember that catching on ludicrously quickly. I mean, that seemed to spread so quickly. And then when it was off air for all those years before the previous special, it only got bigger because it's on Dave or whatever the channel is every night. It's always on. It's one of those shows that people will watch again and again because they like being with the characters. And for me, playing Bryn, it's within my palette, you know, of what I can play. It's a delightful character for me to play.
We're nearly out of time, obviously, and I'm sad to end this conversation because I'm very much enjoying it. But before you go, some quick-fire questions.
I love quick-fire
questions. A little bit of quick-fire questions. So what is the thing that you've done that you are most proud of?
Oh, that's really hard. That's really
hard.
Pick
a favourite child.
Because it so excludes everything else then, doesn't it? I've loved the musical things that I've done. You know, I did a show with Neil Diamond on ITV where I sang with him, and I spent a few days in New York with him interviewing him, and I loved that. I did a show with Tom Jones at Wembley Arena for Children in Need. We did some sketches. I sang some songs with him. You need to be sure of yourself to stand up there with him, you know.
It's fascinating you say that because you are such an, like, without wanting to be reductive, an all-round entertainer.
Well, yeah, I am. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I always like the musical stuff. You know, I've been touring most recently. My live shows have been with a band. You know, we've gone around Britain twice. We've done Australia, New Zealand. You know, people come. You know, and they like it. It's a successful show. I mean, people don't realize because they know you for what you do. So you very slowly start to get, oh yeah, he sings as well, you know. It takes time to build up that recognition. So I've loved doing that because it has been a challenge to get past the tentativeness of being a comedian who's going to sing a sincere song for you on stage, because people's buttocks tighten at the thought of that, don't they? When I started doing the show with the band, I was self-conscious about how I held the microphone stand. If I moved it that way, you're not Rod Stewart. Who do you think you are? Honestly, I was so self-conscious. It took me a lot of stage time to become relaxed and be, you know, I don't throw it in the air and twirl it around my head, but I'm happy to do that with it, perhaps.
Last two quick-fire questions. Tell me the most valuable skill you've ever learned, one that changed your way of doing things.
Well, this is just something that springs to mind. I have become better at writing down ideas when they come to me. I value them more than I did, and I will write them down. It's a very simple thing because I'm not very good at sitting down with a blank piece of paper and going, right, off we go. But I have a lot of ideas. So it's important to write them down.
So much easier going to the notes section of your phone and going,
right.
There's a, if it's nothing, it's nothing,
yeah,
but there's a kernel of an idea there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Final question then. One piece of advice you would give someone wanting to follow in your footsteps, Rob Brydon?
To follow in my footsteps, find your voice, learn from others, learn from those that you admire, take from those that you admire, but find your own voice and don't give up.
Which is what you've done and why you're here. Rob Brydon, to you, a true original. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. Look at that. One glass of champagne has lasted the entire
2.5 hours
of the interview.
And that is it. Thank you to our producers, Lauren Armstrong Carter and Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Lauren Perrier, and of course, to Mr. Rob Brydon for coming in today. Join me again next week when we'll be opening the Savoy's Little Black Book to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be
a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye for now.